Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, October 24th, 2018. We open with the news section, A Bridge to Nowhere. Go Triangle's plans for light rail could cut off downtown Durham from DPAC and the American Tobacco Campus. With the Durham Orange Light Rail Transit Project more than 50% designed, the need for some route changes has become apparent. To that end, over the next few weeks, Go Triangle, the transit agency spearheaded the not-yet-fully-funded project, will release a host of proposals. Among them, closing to traffic the railroad crossing where Blackwell Street becomes Corcoran Street, raising concerns that the American Street Tobacco and the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, the Durham Performing Arts Center, could be cut off from the vibrant downtown they helped to create. Light rail has the potential to create immense opportunity and economic growth, American Tobacco Campus Development Director Mark Stafford, Durham Bulls Vice President Mike Burling, and DPAC General Manager Bob Close wrote in a recent letter to the Durham City Council. But, they continued, in its current and recently altered form, the plan will undoubtedly damage our thriving city center from the downtown core. And so, here we as a community should pause to seek a sharper vision. Go Triangle has already spent about $90 million developing the line, which will run about 18 miles from UNC Chapel Hill through downtown Durham to North Carolina Central. The proposed route alterations come as project developers try to hit tight deadlines imposed by the state legislature and seek a federal grant for half of the $2.47 billion prize tag. The prospect of light rail cleaving the Central Business District and the American Tobacco area first arose in 2015 when plans for a city center station near DPAC were floated. The problem? Running the line along existing rail tracks would require planners to raise Blackwell Street by about 5 to 7 feet so that vehicles driving over the tracks don't get stuck. But raising the street would create an awkward height differential between the street and the sidewalk and the adjacent Old Bull Building, a National Historic Monument, says John Talmage. Instead, as part of the new environmental assessment, Go Triangle intends to release in early November. Go Triangle has proposed a one possible solution, that is installing a pedestrian bridge that would serve as a signature civic space. In their letter, Stanford, Burling, and Klaus argued that the use of the term pedestrian bridge is concerning as the image it conjures falls up far short of the kind of open and inviting connectivity that a truly great downtown requires. They suggested delaying the light rail construction to ensure it's done right. On behalf of the trio, Stanford declined an interview request, saying that the letter speaks for itself. Talmage says the bridge concept will firm up over the next few months following a public input and design process, but the intent is to create a place people actually want to come and be, not just walk across, perhaps to watch the sunset over the city skyline. While Go Triangle is exploring alternatives for the Blackwell Crossing, elevating the line there or running it underground could be cost prohibitive and trigger a lengthy environmental study that would throw off the timeline. That leaves us little time to do radically different solutions, Talmage says. Even with the pedestrian bridge, eliminating the Blackwell Crossing means vehicular traffic would have to be reconfigured downtown. To remedy that, another proposal in the forthcoming assessment suggests converting the lower portion of the downtown loop, Ramseur from Chapel Hill to Diller Street, to two-way traffic. The city plans to eventually make the entire loop two-way. Overall, Talmadge says, GO Triangle's proposed changes aim to improve safety, traffic flow, and access to stations, and some will save money. They include designing the new station near DPAC, elevating a portion of the line on Irwin Road to not interfere with the Duke University hospital access, the emergency vehicles, and the utility line serving the medical complex, and realigning infrastructure at the getaway, at the gateway. All of these plannings has to fit into GO Triangle's timeline for seeking $1.2 billion in federal funding and $190 million in state funding. The state budget passed this summer requires the agency to have commitments for $1 billion in local funding by April 30th. That includes tax and fee revenues from Durham and Orange counties, as well as the proceeds of a private fundraising effort to collect $102 million in land and cash donations. Earlier this month, Talmadge announced the nonprofit GO Transit Partners had secured land donations from UNC and NC Central along the route totaling about $14 million. GO Triangle plans to submit its final applications for federal funding in April. Previously, the agency planned to apply before the end of 2018, with the hope of getting a commitment in September. Per state law, federal funding must be secured by November 30, 2019. If GO Triangle doesn't hit these deadlines, the project will be removed from the current and future consideration for what has been a shrinking contribution from the state. Factoring in all these changes, there's about a 20% contingency built into the light rail budget. Talmadge says GO Triangle is comfortable with that, but that the Federal Transit Administration will conduct a review of plans next month and make its own recommendations on how much of a contingency is needed. In the meantime, GO Triangle will seek public input on all the proposals in the new environmental assessment, specifically regarding what to do with the Blackwell Crossing. But delaying the project, as Klaus, Sanford, and Burling ask, is simply not an option, Mayor Steve Shule responded to them. The delay is to kill it for many, many years, and to put Durham and our region behind every other urban region in the nation in terms of rail transportation in the next 20 years. But just as delaying our application is not an option, neither is it an option to fail to create a signature civic space for the Blackwell-Corcoran crossing. The next news article, No Rest for the Dead. In the last decade, Wake County has allowed developers to dig up and move about 150 graves. Isn't that how poltergeist started? In North Carolina, final resting places aren't always final, at least when it comes to unmarked graves and abandoned folk cemeteries and are relocated to make way for development. Over the last decade, in fact, Wake County has allowed property owners to exhume about 150 graves, including burial sites at North Carolina State's Athletic Complex and the site of a planned Raleigh subdivision. Everybody involved shows the utmost respect, assures Wake County Planner Keith Langford. We want to make sure it's done properly and carefully, thoroughly, and respectfully. Southern folk cemeteries were common in North Carolina before funerals became a commercial industry after World War II. Dating back to the 18th and 19th century, these humble cemeteries were often found on hilltops surrounded by cedar trees and privet hedges, usually with river rocks for grave markers. The history of these burial grounds and the identities of those laid to rest is often lost when the properties change hands, leaving a mystery for the archaeologist and genealogist with whom developers contract to research these sites. That's the case with a property on New Hill Olive Chapel Road outside Apex in southwestern Wake County that Foresight Investments Company, LLC, is set to redevelopment. An archaeological survey identified two weathered tombstones with no visible inscriptions covered by leaves and vegetations in an overgrown area of the property. The property's owners, who had only lived there a few decades, had no idea who was buried on their land. Anyone other than next of kin has to get the county government's approval to move the remains, according to state law. The process requires public hearings, newspaper notices, and reinterment in a well-maintained cemetery. Genealogical research can attempt to find family members, but even in the best cases, that results in a phone call to distant descendants who may not have any idea their relatives owned the property, let alone that they were buried there. Most of these are abandoned cemeteries, and they're overgrown and in poor condition. So the two biggest things the county has to try and identify next of kin and give them the opportunity to comment, Langford said. At the New Hill Olive Chapel Road property, genealogist Deborah Joy was able to trace ownership back to 1816. The graveyard is referenced in deeds dating to 1897, and although only two graves were found, as many as 13 people were buried there, according to Joy's research. She found a few relatives, but none knew anything about the cemetery. So last week, the developer came before the Wake County Board of Commissioners with an application to relocate the two graves. All but one commissioner, Greg Ford, signed off. Ford said that moving remains runs afoul of his religious beliefs. My faith tradition is one where final resting place really does mean final resting place, Ford said. There's not an asterisk there if it impedes progress or profit. Commissioner Jessica Holmes said she agreed with Ford on moral grounds, but she voted for the relocation anyway, saying the graves would be better cared for in Oakwood Cemetery. Morally, I believe that disinterment is wrong, she said, but as an attorney and elected official, I respect that the guidelines have been abided by. With the relocation approved, a meticulous process has been set in motion, beginning with exhumation. Even in graves just a few decades old, you're unlikely to find much in the ground due to the Piedmont soil condition, says NC State forensic anthropologist Ann Ross. While corpses elsewhere can be preserved for hundreds or even thousands of years, this part of North Carolina has very moist, high alkaline and acidic clay soil, which accelerates decomposition. Bones actually last longer in the sun than underground here. Studies have shown that bodies disappear completely in about 35 years, leaving only the shadow of bone as a faint outline in the dirt. Excavators typically find only about an inch deep layer of discolored dirt, an outline of a casket or a body, and metal coffin ring hinges. This was a case in 2014, when Langford oversaw the exhumation of 30 graves from what is now North Carolina State's indoor football training facility. Only one grave was marked. It belonged to a Reverend John W. Dalton, the pastor of a church formerly on the property, and was dated 1943. Earlier this year, the county approved the relocation of 53 graves from a planned Raleigh subdivision, whose graves were marked only by rocks at their head and foot. Known only to God, as they say, Langford says. Whatever left of the grave is placed into a small wooden box and numbered by location, so that when they're reinterred, the families are kept together. Cremation isn't an option under state law, but even if that weren't the case, burning the remains might cause complicated moral issues. We don't know who these people were, Langford said. We don't know what their feelings were about cremation. And now, our feature story, Creature Comforts. When we ask our staff and writers to name their favorite comfort food, everyone responded with something different. Well, that's not surprising, given that food is so subjective and personal. Whether you seek out a bowl of pho to fight a cold, a slice of pizza to remedy a bad day, or a basket of dumplings to celebrate a good one, food has the power to transport us to a happy time and place, one rich and warm with a sense of family and home. But even if our cravings are rooted in nostalgia, the magic of comfort food is that it still allows for fresh discovery. Even a dish you're trying for the first time can become a comfort food, either because of who you're eating it with or something familiar it calls to mind. Such eating experiences don't simply recall home, they let us redefine it, no matter where our table is set. In this edition of Dish, we tuck into the many guises of comfort food, whether you want to cook it for yourself, find it in restaurants, or prepare it for others. We dig deep into meat pies and dumplings, savory treats that take many forms but are a common thread with comfort in many global areas. Speaking of global, our Australian correspondent weighs in on finding solace in that most American Southern of cuisines, biscuits and gravy. Two stories explore how comfort can be found in cooking, and check out the recipe for green curry mussels, not just in eating. We also report on the science behind comfort food, and we pick a baker's dozens of our favorites in Triangle restaurants. Of course, we don't neglect the fact that, even for chefs and foodies, sometimes only a Waffle House or a mall food court can sate that particular hunger for something familiar, whether you're in your hometown or on the other side of the world. House of ill repute. There's home cooking and fine dining, but even famous chefs want Waffle House now and then. To be honest, I was more than a little skeptical. My husband and I had just moved to the Triangle from Elizabeth City, a sleepy little town in the very northeastern corner of the state. The holidays were just around the corner, and I was really starting to miss my family and old friends. A new friend, Holly, knew I was feeling blue. One evening, she showed up at my house and told me she was taking me someplace that would cheer me up. When she pulled her car into the parking lot of a Waffle House, skepticism morphed into flat-out disbelief. How was some dodgy, greasy spoon chain eatery going to make me feel better? I wasn't even sure that it was safe to eat there. When we walked in, a waitress greeted us like she'd been expecting us and eagerly awaited our arrival. "Do you know her?" I asked Holly. "Never seen her before in my life," she answered with a glitter of mischief in her eye. We took a seat and Holly ordered for both of us. She requested cheese omelets, Cokes with light vanilla, and hash browns, scattered, smothered, and covered. The omelet was a revelation. They beat the eggs in a milkshake machine, so it turns out puffy and light, almost souffle-like. But that's the only fancy thing about it. The cheese is basic American. The fat they use is the kind of institutional cooking oil that comes in barrels, and the pans they use are generic restaurant supply. But these humble elements come together to make this steaming, yellow cheese-filled plate of breakfast a nirvana. And can we talk about those perfectly crispy hash browns with a pantry's worth of possible additions? There's the menu lingo, and that's not only denotes your favorite combo, scattered, that's on the grill, smothered, with onions, covered, cheese, chunked, ham, and so on, but also separates the vets from the newbies and becomes the basis for friendly debates between strangers. After the first meal with Holly, Waffle House became the place I wanted to go after a bad day. I've since learned that the Waffle House friendly greeting is standard issue at every location, but that doesn't diminish its warmth. And I know that with every visit, my go-to order, a cheese omelet, scattered, smothered, and covered hash browns, and a vanilla Coke, light on the vanilla, will satisfy every time. Next, gravy train. How an Australian transplant managed homesickness with a southern dish she never thought she'd love. If somebody told me that biscuits and gravy would become my go-to comfort food, I'd have laughed in their face. When I moved to Durham from Australia a year ago, I had a hard enough time thinking of biscuits as savory. Biscuits are cookies where I'm from. Not to mention getting my head around the idea of gravy-soaked dough. For me, American biscuits are equivalent to the British scone, which we eat with jam and cream. Though queso filled the void in my late-night snacking routine, one I didn't know existed, in my frequent bouts of homelessness, nothing edible came to mind. But a couple of months ago, I found myself unable to politely resist when my friend offered me a taste of what I had written off as an unappetizing beige breakfast, and everything changed. It was the ham and cheese biscuit with Nisa's sausage gravy at Durham's Joe Van Gogh coffee shop. Only available on weekends, the creamy gravy with sausage chunks literally smothers the soft biscuit halves. Surprisingly, the dough, baked with tender bites of ham and cheese, never gets soggy, perfect for mopping up the last of the gravy. It dawned on me that the gravy reminded me of home. As a child, I'd suffered terrible tonsillitis right through my early 20s until a doctor finally agreed to remove them. As my throat swelled and swallowing proved impossible, my mother prescribed an aspirin gargle chased with a bowl of mashed potatoes and gravy, a tradition I continued when my two boys suffered from the same affliction. My father's auntie used to make gravy by adding lard to pork chop pan juices, while my mother's mother made gravy with drippings from our Sunday roast. But the real gravy clincher for me is my mother's pies. My mother passed away unexpectedly in October of 2009. I had visited her 3 weeks earlier. At the time, we lived in different states, she in southern Australia and me in Victoria, and she had made piping hot homemade savory pies for dinner, a classic beef one with brown gravy filling, and my favorite, chicken and vegetables with a white gravy, not unlike Alabama white sauce. Had I known that this was to be the last time I was going to eat her pies, I might have enjoyed them more, perhaps less, but regardless, it was a taste of home, a taste of my childhood, a taste of my mother. Recently, I started making my own gravy in my southern kitchen, playing around with online recipes and ones that were gifted to me by fellow gravy connoisseurs. I ladle country-style sausage gravy over pork, bake savory beef pies simmered in gravy, make classic chicken gravy with the roasting juices, and plan to try my hand at red-eye ham gravy. Yet my favorite way to get gravy is poured over warm biscuits. Having recently suffered a career setback, I found myself sitting at the counter at Joe Van Gogh with a plate of biscuits and gravy before me. Nursing a mild hangover, I sipped a black coffee before shoveling in a mouthful of comfort. I was pleasantly surprised that it had an extra kick in it this time, thanks to the addition of hot sausage and hot sauce. Just the extra boost I needed to get me through till next time. Now, home court advantage. For a world traveler, mall food courts bring comfort from the States to Swaziland. For some comfort food, it means a great aunt's hearty stew or dad's special enchiladas, dishes that evoke the familiarity of home and meals shared with family. But I have spent a good chunk of my life away from the places and people I call home, eating by myself in unfamiliar locations, So I've had to learn how to make myself comfortable in places where I don't necessarily feel at home. This is why I love the mall snack. Hot, buttered, large pretzels, satisfying, oversalted. Sticky cinnamon rolls smothered with cream cheese frostings. Hot dog on a stick. None of these constitute a balanced diet, and all are unnecessarily, sickeningly indulgent. They are the kind of food one would only eat at a mall where lavish consumption is not just permitted, but mandated. But there are treats one can eat just about anywhere in the world. Malls, the modern inheritors of marketplaces, bazaars, and mercados, exist across the globe. Even as we regularly read stories about the closures of malls across the country, 20 to 25% are projected to close in the next 5 years, according to Credit Suisse. These news stories are paired with others about Dubai outdoing itself to build the largest mall in the world, American developers moving abroad to build malls, and Chinese shoppers going wild for outlet malls. When we think of global food brands, we tend to think of KFC, Hard Rock Cafe, or Starbucks. Not as much attention has been paid to the food companies who have globalized through malls, like barnacles on the skin of a whale. Auntie Anne's and its pretzels exist in South Korea, Turkey, Cambodia, and Brazil. More than 1,000 Cinnabon stores operate across 48 countries, and mall locations are the crux of their businesses. Once I was working in Swaziland and eating a diet comprised almost exclusively of stewed meat and mashed corn. I worked and lived in a context where I was barely functional in the dominant language, and I spent most of my free time watching The Wire, which bundled up in layers of sweatshirts. On a free weekend, I drove a few hours to Johannesburg and visited my first mall in months. In that mall, I saw the gleaming logo of a Cinnabon, and my heart leapt. I ordered a classic roll with a side of extra cream cheese frosting. I promised myself that I would savor it, but I am pretty sure I gulped it down in 3 whole bites. The indulgence felt like a homecoming. In Dubai, I took refuge at an Auntie Anne's, in Istanbul, another Cinnabon. Less obvious than a McDonald's, these spots offered me a taste of home without the white flag of surrendering to tourist hotspots. So it's no surprise that the Northgate Mall food court has become one of my most cherished refuges in Durham. It has pepperoni pizza, hard-shell tacos, orange chicken, lamb gyros, and miso soup, each as fast food spots with generic names like chopsticks or Greek cuisine. Like the cover of a textbook from the 90s, Northgate's food court promises diversity and blunt stereotypes. But Northgate Mall has its own local charm. Absent are most of the department stores that define a luxury mall like South Point. Instead, Northgate boasts a DMV, a second-hand clothes store, nail salons, tailors, a shoe repair shop, and even a branch of the Durham Public Library. And once you get over the post-apocalyptic eeriness of walking past a row of empty storefronts, the mall feels communal and inclusive in a way that so few pieces do in the center of Durham. There is a weekly walking group that strides purposefully as they make their laps. Children ride a miniature carousel outside Sears. Sweets and News offers the equivalent of a bodega with a clerk who knows my order. Northgate feels like one of the last puttering heartbeats of Durham of yesteryear. With 2 new food malls set to open in the next year, it may feel like public dining options in Durham are at their all-time best. But prices at these new food halls will likely exceed the cost of a food court meal. Not to mention, they exist in gentrified neighborhoods, host to luxury apartment buildings and residential high-rises. Northgate, meanwhile, draws in the crosshatch locals of Walltown and Bragtown. On a recent Sunday afternoon, the food cart was full of families, young professionals, and retirees, all sitting down to eat pupusos, teriyaki chicken, and pizza. Next, mood food. Nostalgia is a key comfort food ingredient, but science explains what really drives our cravings. As I sink my fork tines through the pasta shell blanketed in red sauce and stuffed with cheese, I am transported to my grandma's kitchen. I can smell garlic sizzling in olive oil. I can see her standing at the counter. I can hear the spoon clinking against the sides of a metal mixing bowl, scraping up the ricotta filling. I savor a mouthful, feeling a warmth emanating from my core, the kind of hug from which only that combination of cheese-stiff noodles nestled and baked in sauce elicits. My grandma may not have made the pan of manicotti. I devoured that during a particular deadline-heavy week. But nostalgia is a heady ingredient. Just the smell and taste of the dish made me feel comfort in a way that few foods can. It makes sense. Living in 6 different countries before the age of 15, my sitter's table and the pans of manicotti and platters of grape leaves, hummus, and freshly baked pita our family shared together every summer, I was where I felt most at home. Food preferences are personal, particularly when it comes to comfort food. After all, fond food memories are influenced by where you grew up eating, and with whom. But research shows that our minds have just as much sway over our comfort food cravings as our hearts. From a psychological standpoint, humans eat because we need energy. To meet those metabolic nutritional needs, we are inherently wired to seek out energy-dense food, those that are rich in carbohydrates, fats, and protein. When those foods also taste good, our bodies crave them even more. It's no surprise that Americans' favorite comfort foods fit that makeup. In a 2015 Harris Poll survey of 2,252 adults, pizza tops the list as the most popular comfort food. Chocolate and ice cream tie for second, and mac and cheese and chips round out the top 5. Jonathan Allen, a professor at North Carolina State University's Department of Food, Bioprocessing, and Nutrition Sciences, explains why that is. A lot of these foods that are very popular, particular snack foods, are high in sugar, salt, and fat. Sometimes the sugar is there and you don't even notice it. If you hold a starchy food in your mouth for a little bit, you have enzymes that make sugars, and you can taste the sweetness that you don't taste when you first put it in your mouth, he said. That's an evolved response to learning that a food that has starch is pleasurable, so you want to eat more of that food because it's high in available energy. In a 2003 University of Illinois study exploring comfort food preferences, Brian Wozniak cites evidence that certain foods can have seemingly addictive qualities and that eating highly palatable foods also releases trace amounts of opiates, which elevate mood and satisfaction. Lindsay Tansky, a postdoctoral teaching scholar at NC State and a public health and nutrition expert, says that besides being tasty, comfort food triggers and preferences are all determined by psychological factors. There's this idea of highly palatable foods that have an almost addictive quality, triggering a reward in the brain and keeps us coming back for more. Comfort food, specifically, is associated with nostalgia and a specific association we have with a person, a place, or a time that evokes comfort. As a result, research pertaining to the psychology of comfort food preferences tends to focus on triggers, when or why we seek out the foods we do, and what the measurable benefit effects are. Next, muscle memory. When love ends, eat your heart out. Years ago, toward the tail end of the collapse of a 10-year relationship, I escaped to Charlotte for a night with a friend who had a spare ticket to a Sufjan Stevens concert. We went out to eat before the show and shared a pot of green curry mussels. We plucked the meaty morsels from the shells and dipped hunks of crusty French bread into the tangy coconut broth as we dissected what had become of my life. The dish was perfectly balanced and harmonious, whereas my life was disjointed and in shambles. And then I went and sobbed through an excellent Sufjan concert. Later, toward the start of a new relationship, I decided to recreate the green curry mussels dish from memory. I fashioned a dining room out of two camp chairs and a folding table. My ex took most of the furniture and plopped a steaming pot of mussels onto the table alongside a bowl of bread slices, and we dug in. I had no television, so we listened to some records and talked into the night. It was the first time my boyfriend came over to my house and one of our first real dinners together, and it was wonderful. Green curry mussels have seen me through highs and lows ever since. For me, they hit all the right comfort food notes. They're simple and quick to make. They're a one-pot dish that requires very little cleanup, and then they can be made from memory for all of life's moments, big and small. They are exotic, yet informal. Green curry mussels also know no season. They're just as at home in the sweltering summer heat as they are on a chilly January night. Most of all, green curry mussels remind me that in one of my darkest moments, when I truly thought I had nowhere to turn, sharing a simple pot of food with a friend brought me a little joy. It's a dish that reminds me of that night huddled around a folding table in an otherwise empty living room, laughing and talking and flirting with a man who just last month became my husband. Green curry mussels are now our comfort food, a dish we turn to when we need a boost, when we're feeling nostalgic, or when we just want to have a good time and eat with our fingers. I perfected my recipe for green curry mussels, but the beauty of the dish is that it continues to evolve as I evolve. Next, good grief. A stress eater heals from a personal loss by feeding others instead. I've always been in a stress eater. When the going gets tough, I get busy eating. In my 20s, bags of peanut M&Ms were college exam study buddies. I devoured them seven at a time for good luck, so I'd pass my journalism classes. As a New York City publicist, my remedy to a crummy day was picking up a crumbly apple turnover from Zabar's on my way home. Don't get me started on the dating disappointments, like the guy who, after a few dinners, invited me to the Sugar Bowl only to ghost me on my big day. My game day MMT was a pint of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia. My relationship with stress eating experienced a seismic shift in my late 30s when my 74-year-old mother suddenly passed away. She still lived in New Jersey, and while I moved to Raleigh several years earlier, a four-pack-a-day smoker for most of her life, my mother had asthma and COPD, but nothing stopped her. My mother was invincible as she and my dad wintered in Florida and spent weekends dancing and going to shows in the retirement community. Mom loved visiting Atlantic City and playing the slots, though the one-armed bandits never wore her out. We were incredibly close, speaking on the phone several times a day, and she was my go-to for our favorite family recipes like roasted chicken, potato latkes, and chicken noodle soup. In the year after her death, I mourned, but instead of eating my feelings, I unintentionally found a different way to use food for comfort. I cooked up a storm daily. I became obsessed with Food Network, especially Emero Live and Essence of Emerald, along with the whirlwind of taking care of my family, which included little ones aged 5 and 2. I bammed my way through new recipes. There was something soothing and therapeutic in the repetition of chopping and dicing, a meditative quality to the stirring and ladling of soups and sauces. And all I did was taste. I didn't make meals out of the dishes springing from my test kitchen, but I also didn't want the food to go to waste. So, instead of shoveling everything into my gullet or the garbage, I ferried portions to friends all over North Raleigh. My favorite appetizer from that year was orange glazed chicken wings, which became a welcome dinner to a sick mom friend with small kids. A white spinach lasagna made a delicious one-pan entree while it was my turn to host supper club. Baking was never my thing, but a dense chocolate ganache topped with fresh raspberries and homemade whipped cream became my favorite potluck dish. My friends didn't mind a bit. I'm a good cook, and they were eager taste testers and frequent diners in my home. During those 12 grieving months, if I wasn't in the kitchen, I stayed busy ferrying my kids to school and activities, often crying silently in my car so they wouldn't know Mommy was sad. Or I spent time working on a novel about a New York City single gal with a dying mother, my heartbreak ever present. I found comfort in distraction by hosting frequent dinner parties and 2 big bashes for 50 guests each, a 35th birthday party for my husband, and a baby shower for a good friend. I was a caterer, handling all the cooking and serving myself. My kitchen became stocked with professional catering equipment, including chafing dishes, tiered food stands, and enough dishes and flatware to serve 50. For my husband's birthday party, I hired a local wine store for tastings. And when the co-owner learned that I would be making and serving all the food, he proposed we partner in a catering business. But I was a writer, not a caterer, so I kindly declined. It wasn't so strange that I found comfort in preparing food after my mother passed away. In suburban New Jersey house where I grew up, my mother believed food was love. Her modus operandi was rooted in her childhood. She was a Holocaust survivor, starved through teen years spent in a war-torn Lithuanian ghetto and a concentration camp. She told stories about her first post-war year when she worked in a Vienna hotel kitchen and ate everything in sight. Happy laughter accompanied her retelling of how fat she got in only a few months. One of my strongest childhood memories is hearing my mother ask every visitor crossing our threshold, "Can I get you something to eat?" Our cupboards were well stocked, as if my mom's stacking of cans and boxes of food were her way of building a tin and cardboard wall to keep our future hunger. When the one-year anniversary of my mother's death passed, my fever for whipping up new dishes waned, though the experience wasn't for naught. As a fledgling fiction writer, food began infusing my prose and became fodder for many articles and essays. With hindsight, I know my year of comforting myself with cooking gave birth to my food writing journey, and one more thing that I owe to my mom. The next, In the Pocket. From the microwave to global cuisine, meat pies fill more than their flaky crusts. It's 3:30 p.m., sometime in the 90s. As for many latchkey kids, it's time for me to run to the school bus, walk the dog, and then book in back to school before whatever extracurricular activity is on the docket. I throw my backpack into the den, leash Duke up, and head outside. But not before doing the most important thing. Tossing a Hot Pocket, pepperoni, ham and cheese, meatballs, take your pick, into the microwave and setting the timer to 3 minutes. Once the dog has walked, it won't quite be too molten to eat, and I can jump into the pile of kids carpooling back to school. To my middle-aged self, the Hot Pocket symbolized freedom and self-reliance. These days, I have a lot more to worry about than grabbing a bite and being on time for practice without help from my parents. But something about pastry crust sealed around a meat filling still evokes comfort for me. As an adult, it takes more than a nukable processed snack to sate my foodie palate. My go-to grown-up Hot Pockets are a tie between El Salvadorian pupusas from Pupuseria La Metapaneca on Holloway Street and the Jamaican patty, preferably goat, from Golden Crust Caribbean Bakery and Grill on Duke Street. Both take me back to my early childhood summers in Brooklyn, tossing a few bucks to a street vendor and biting in, hoping, not to scald myself, but hastening to let the savory, spicy goodness flood my taste buds. Thick cornmeal tortilla gives way to savory, spicy beef and tangy, bitter cotito on the side, or gamey goat meat and earthy curry burst from a turmeric brush turnover. Nearly every culture has some sort of meat-filled pastries. Restaurants all over the triangle have tapped into the nostalgia of things that remind people of homes far away, or the novelty of sharing a staple dish from another culture. Just like sweet pies, savory ones bursting with meat, spices, and starches, they require wonderful crusts and some contrast. Most meat pie crusts are simply flour, salt, and oil. Maybe an egg wash to baste or spice to finish in baked versions. Cultures where people walked miles to work meant that the crust had to hold up to travel and had to be dense enough to hold in juices and liquefying fats while cooking. After baking or frying, often in open community ovens or over open flames, these meat-filled pies made for hearty meals on the go. When I think of empanadas, like the ones from Durham's Luna Rotisserie, an empanada, born in the Americas in Spain, Viceroy Samosas, which call India home, and Gusha's Ethiopian Sambusas, we can point to climate and culture as another driver of the dish. Spices and salt were used as preservatives before modern refrigeration, both to make the meat last longer and to mask the flavor of meat that had perhaps lasted a bit too long. Meats like goat and lamb were early bases in the Caribbean, while ham, fish, and corn were primary fillers in continental South America. Similarly, spices like cumin and bases like peas and seeds were used as filling in India. Most of these pastries have a flaky, salty crust that pairs perfectly with the spicy fillings. Great Britain's meat pie, the Cornish pastry, is made to eat hot or cold during a standing lunch and to provide the caloric fuel that powered the growth of the British Empire and life in the mines of Cornwall. The pastry takes advantage of the food root vegetables that grow easily in this climate, turnips, potatoes, and onions, and the Brit filled it with beef. No good Brit would be caught having a pasty without a side of HP sauce, but this American would be fine with A1. Despite being separated by the pond, the two sauces are kin, both tomato-based with malt vinegar, salt, pepper, and other spices. HP or A1, this girl is a dunker, not a pourer. After all, wouldn't want to make the crust soggy? If you're really lucky, the turnips will still have a little bit of snap, and the rich tang of the sauce will highlight the earthiness of the veggies. even if you nab one from Forthright Brewery and carry and take it home for later. It's great to bite right into cold. The crust is a highlight of the room temperature. It's short and powdery and crumbles just right to complement the beef. And even if it's not a handheld take, the chicken pot pie at Tyler's Tap Room is just like my grandma used to make and perfect for a cold day. It's also been known to cure hangovers. Be careful, though. I know from experience that the light crust and perfectly cooked carrots and white meat chicken in a savory white gravy can be downright addictive. Now, Half Moon Happiness. My heart raced at the looming stress of starting my first dissertation chapter, and it caused me to stare blankly at my laptop screen. A savory aroma wafted through the air, and I glanced to see my roommate folding dough around ground meat, using a technique she learned from her Chinese grandmother. Heat escaped the bamboo basket as she lifted the lid and kindly offered me a freshly steamed dumpling. Though they were a far cry from the bowls brimming with my Texas grandma's creamy chicken and biscuit dumplings, they simply relaxed my nerves, comforted me despite the constant stress of graduate school. From mama's to Xiao Long Bao, these pockets of minced meat or vegetables enveloped in dough are universally appealing, not only offering solace after a tough day, but serving as windows into diverse cultures who eat dumplings for both everyday and special occasions. Never turn down an offer for homemade dumplings, but if a craving strikes when you're on the go, restaurants around the triangle are turning our stellar versions. Taiwanese dumplings. When picturing Asian dumplings, these pleated parcels are the variety that comes to mind for me. Sophia Wu, co-owner of Raleigh's Mofu Shop, exclusively serves this style of dumpling in her restaurant, following her beloved generation's old family recipe. Their plumped horn shape represents prosperity, as it closely resembles the gold ingots used as currency during the Ming Dynasty. Wu deems these pockets everyday dumplings, as their preparation and consumption bring families together on any occasion. However, many Chinese families still enjoy them on holidays, like Lunar New Year, and may even hide a coin inside one of the dumplings, so one person receives an extra dose of luck. Xiao Long Bao, soup dumplings. Sipping tea while sharing dim sum dishes like Xiao Long Bao is an ideal way to spend a weekend morning. Popular in Southeast China, these dumplings contain a congealed meat filling that dissolves into a soup once steamed in a bamboo steamer. Placing one on a wide spoon and breaking the thin skin releases the soup onto the spoon. They're also one of the most popular dumplings in Raleigh's Brewery Bahana, which Chef Chun Li calls delicious and adorable. While she first learned how to create this complex circular dumpling from online tutorials, she perfected the technique by interviewing the general manager of Shanghai's renowned Nanjing restaurant, whose family members have made soup dumplings for generations. Momos. In Nepal, momos, pleated dumplings stuffed with vegetables or meats such as chicken or buffalo, are a common street food snack because of their crested shape. I thought momos would taste similar to Chinese steamed dumplings, but a bite revealed a dense interior blended with curry spices. When I first ate the Johor momo dish at Karamundo Kitchen in Kerry, I realized why Nepalese families convene over these dumplings whenever a craving or rainy day hits. Slurping the jhal or spicy broth elevates the flavor of the momos and has the ability to not only soften the thick hour later, but my general disposition. Samosas. I used to only perceive samosas as having a starring role in Indian food, occasionally making a cameo in Pakistani or Nepalese menus. But after a recent dinner at Jwali's in Durham, I discovered that several African cuisines included samosas too. Chef owner Zwili Williams grew up in Zimbabwe, eating samosas both at home and at restaurants. After observing the distant takes on the flavors and fillings at the neighborhood cafes, she then developed her own recipes. Pagosis. These semicircular dumplings, popular in Central and Eastern Europe, involving stuffing carbs into more carbs, so I imagine that they deliver a mega dose of comfort. John Korzewinski, a chef owner of Jay Betsky's in Raleigh, seems to agree. Korzewinski first learned the art of pierogi making from his family and attributes the dense texture of the dough to the addition of sour cream. First-timers can experience the old world by selecting traditional fillings like potato and cheese or sauerkraut. But pierogies function as an everyday staple. They also enjoy a prime spot of holiday menus. As a result, Korzewinski may feature elevated ingredients like oxtail and lobster or dessert varieties that include sweet cheese or fruit. As a nod to our locale, Korzewinski even makes pierogies filled with Carolina barbecue and tangy vinegar sauce. Now, in closing, a reminder that Election Day is coming up, and early voting runs through Saturday, November 3rd. These sites in Durham, the County Board of Elections Office, Duke University Broadhead Center, East Regional Library, North Carolina Central North Regional Library, and South Regional Library. In Orange, County Board of Elections Office, Carborough Town Hall, Chapel of Cross, Seymour Senior Center, and the Eflin Raritan Club Building. And in Wake, the Apex Community Center, the Chavez Community Center, County Board of Elections Office, Herbert C. Young Community Center, Nightdale Recreation Center, Lake Lynn Community Center, NCSU Tally Student Union, Northern Regional Center, Optimus Community Center, Wake Tech Campus College, and the Physical Education Building. Well, that's about it for this week. Be sure to vote, and we'll be back next week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.